Hey everybody, my name is Rolf with the Oxygen Collective. I'm so glad to be here in Olympia today. Been having a great time on this tour. How are you guys doing? Good? All right. Let's talk about the Siskiyou Wild Rivers area. You've heard a bit about it from Laurel and from Leslie and others so far, but let's really get to know this place and what's in store from the Bush administration. So the Siskiyou Wild Rivers area is a real wild place. We're talking about the largest unprotected wild forests between Canada and Mexico on the West Coast. Extraordinary wild place where you can see hill after hillside of untouched forests. Kind of place where you can still really get away from it all. Where you can go for a week-long backpacking trip and not see another soul. Wild rivers. We call it the Siskiyou Wild Rivers area because there's more wild and scenic rivers in this part of the country. More wild and scenic rivers than any other part of the nation. We got the Chetco. We have the North Fork of the Smith. The Rogue. The Elk. And my favorite, the wild and scenic Illinois River. Also the botanical diversity. You already heard a bit about that, but of course the Siskiyou National Forest is the most botanically diverse national forest in the whole country. Extraordinary. If you want to get to know some plants and flowers that don't exist anywhere else on Earth, come on down to the Siskiyou. There's surprises everywhere, especially this time of year, early spring and summer, like these white irises popping up on the forest floor. Around every corner, something new to see. Now, this special place, this forest belongs to all of us, to all Americans. They're public forests, national forests. Now, when most people look on maps and they see Siskiyou National Forest with kind of a boundary and it's maybe shaded green, most people think that they're protected, sort of like national parks, that they're set aside and that they're protected for future generations. I wish I could sit here and tell you that, but it's simply not the case. There's been a lot of mistakes and mismanagement that's happened in the Siskiyou. This was the Sugarloaf timber sale. The Forest Service came to us and said, you know, you have some unhealthy forests up there on Sugarloaf Mountain. I said, Sugarloaf Mountain, unhealthy forests? What do you guys mean? That's an old growth forest. That's a roadless forest. It's never been mucked up before through mismanagement. They said, look, the problem is you guys have got this little trees here that are growing too close to the big trees. So what happens if a fire moves through is that the fire will burn up the little tree and then up into the canopy of the big trees and you'll have a catastrophic wildfire. And we can't have that. And I thought, well, geez, you know, when the forest gets too thick, these native forests have ways of thinning themselves out. Sort of like the stick that I'm holding here that my friend Lou Gold gave to me. It used to be a baby Douglas fir. Grew up with a lot of other baby Douglas firs. But over time, insects or disease or just plain competition, the shade knocked it out. It died off and was going to return to the soil, and some of its peers were going to grow up into big trees, of course. That's just kind of the way things have been happening for thousands of years on our national forest. So why do we need to go in there with chainsaws anyway? The Forest Service said, look, you have to trust us. We're going to use environmentally sensitive methods. We're just going to pluck out these little trees using helicopters. We're not going to build new roads. We're going to be light on the land. Just give us a chance. Well, when their logging plans came out, we went on the ground and we saw 1,000 of these big old growth trees marked with blue paint. And if you've ever been to a timber sale on public lands before, you'll know that blue paint means this one gets logged. This one's got to go. So we ran back to the Forest Service. What's going on here? I thought you guys were talking about environmentally sensitive methods and plucking out little trees with helicopters. What's going on with those 1,000 old growth trees you've got marked for cutting? They said, look, we were telling you the truth. We are going to be environmentally sensitive. We are going to just pluck out little trees with helicopters. But you see, all of that is expensive, and we need to pay for it somehow. And that's what the big trees are about. We learned a hard lesson on Sugarloaf. We learned that whenever you combine commercial logging, the need to make a buck off of our national forests, whenever you combine that with fire safety or restoration or any other kind of management activity, it just doesn't work. Look, they're talking about fire safety here. They took out the biggest, most fire-resistant part of the forest. These old-growth trees with their thick bark have resisted fires for decades or centuries. The fires come and go, they reseed and create the new forest. In addition, when they take out these big old-growth trees, they've opened up the canopy so that the sunlight comes in and makes this bottom forest floor hotter and drier and more prone to fire. And in addition, when you open up the canopy and that sunlight comes in, it stimulates the growth of these plants down here. They grow up thick and brushy. Most fires move along the forest floor, not up in the canopy. And so you've increased the fuels along the ground for the fires to burn. And speaking of fuels, after logging like this, you leave behind the bark and the branches, slash is what it's called. You leave slash along the ground, and that in turn acts like kindling, sitting behind waiting for the next fire to happen. They completely increased the fire risk of this area while saying that they were doing it in the name of fire safety. It just doesn't work. And of course, it's a disaster for the ecology of the area. And industrial commercial logging over the years has done more than just take out the big trees and increase fire risk. It's left behind a network of roads, thousands and thousands and thousands of miles. More roads in our national forests than our entire interstate highway system. Punched into wild areas to facilitate logging like the stuff on Sugarloaf Mountain. And then left to rot often, washing out, and you can imagine the effects that has for streams and rivers nearby. In addition, these roads are like superhighways for weeds and invasive diseases that travel along tires and equipment and that sort of thing. There's a lot of mistakes that have happened in our national forests over the last 50, 60 years. There's a lot of lessons to be learned. There's a lot of things we can start doing right. But unfortunately, this administration doesn't see it that way. They're taking giant steps backwards. The attacks that they're unleashing on our national forests, I like to refer to as the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. Coming soon to a forest near you. It's true. The Bush administration has been relentless and deliberate in its rollbacks and attacks on just about every forest protection law you could think of. I could stand here all night and go through the list and explain what each one means for our public lands. I'm not going to do that. I'll spare both you and me. Needless to say, these rollbacks and attacks have attacked roadless forests, old growth forests, streams and salmon-bearing rivers, sensitive species, endangered species, drinking water, just about everything you could think of. This administration has pulled. Even in the last couple of weeks, they've been busy rolling back these things. A complete disaster, a huge step backwards in the management of our national forests. Now, what all that adds up to is tens of millions of acres of federal forests, forests that belong to you and me, that are at greater risk now of the type of logging that we saw on Sugarloaf Mountain. That's what's in store. Now, the Siskiyou is part of that, and we're starting to see some of these bad new projects where the public is pulled out of the process and environmental laws are pulled out of the process, hitting the ground in the wild Siskiyou. Now, in addition to those things, we're now seeing the largest logging project ever proposed anywhere in the modern history of our national forests in southwestern Oregon in the wild Siskiyou. And they're using the Biscuit Fire as a smokescreen to facilitate that. So let's get to know the Biscuit Fire first. July 13th, 2002, extraordinarily hot, dry summer. Thousands of lightning strikes hit the wild backcountry of the Siskiyou. They dropped to the ground without a drop of rain. Dry lightning strikes. After a long, hot, dry summer, you bet that starts some fires, and that's exactly what happened. A whole bunch of little fires started in the wild backcountry of the Siskiyou. The Forest Service sent in some crews and then pulled them out. Decided, let's let these ones burn for a little while. Even though these fires started a month earlier than normal, because it was so hot and dry at the time, they waited for the fires to get big, and then they sent in a military-style firefighting extravaganza in some ways. At the time, it was the most expensive firefighting effort in the history of the United States. Thousands and thousands of troops, Humvees, tanks, modified tanks on the ground. We had helicopters and air support and old bombers overhead, even explosions ripping up hillsides, blowing up the serpentine forest, combining it with bulldozers to create a huge fire line, a huge perimeter around these many fires that were burning in the Siskiyou. So now they've encircled it with hundreds of miles of this fire line, and then they did something called backburning. A lot of people look at this slide and they think that this is a truck that's spraying water. It's not. It's spraying a napalm-like substance into the forest and lighting the forest on fire on purpose. Now, what's the idea behind that? Well, the idea is you burn the forests from the perimeter back towards the real fire so that if the real fire ever gets that close, there's less to burn. How much backburning did they do? They did a lot. Here's a drip torch at night setting the forest on fire. Here's even a guy shooting a tree to light it on fire with a flare gun. Lots of fun toys to work with here. Here's backburn. Whole hillsides, whole river canyons, roadless forests, old growth reserves, burned on purpose by the Bush Forest Service. How much did they burn? One of the natural questions you might wonder. How much did you guys burn? Their answer is, we can't tell you. Their answer is, we don't know, or we don't want to know, or we don't want you to know how much we burned on purpose. Even shots like this, which you may have seen in the evening news or in your local paper, shots like this were of the backburn. This is not the biscuit fire. This is the biscuit fire fighting. But most folks, when they open up the local newspaper and look at this shot, they think, oh my dear God, these people here are about to get burned to a crisp. Little do they know the firefighting is what's looming overhead here, and that the firefighting itself is 3 miles away from this ranch, and that between this ranch and the firefighting, there's a river, and between the river and the firefighting is a firefighter's camp with hundreds of firefighters. These folks were under no threat whatsoever at all. But it was all part of this fire hysteria that was being whipped up across the nation to push an extreme logging agenda. The real fire inside that fire perimeter I told you about looks a lot like this right now. This shot was taken just about a month ago. You might be surprised to see that the mighty biscuit fire looks like this in many parts. You have to understand that within that 500,000 acres, not everything just got bulldozed by the fire. Fire hopscotches around, burning some areas and not others. The fire actually moved through this whole landscape here. Might be surprising to see. Let's zoom in a little bit. You can see here a few of the smaller trees taken out, some of the big ones here and there, a lot of the brush being taken out. The fire's moving along the ground in what's called an underburn. An underburn. According to the Forest Service, 61%, overwhelming majority of everything within that fire perimeter was either completely unburned or experienced a low-intensity fire. 61%. And that's pretty typical for large natural fires in our forests. Now, there's also hot intensity and medium intensity fires, and all those things are good and natural in the Siskiyou. Here's what a low intensity fire looks like. A lot of the brush taken out, some of the bigger trees are scarred, maybe a big tree here and there killed by the fire. There was also a lot of hot burn. Here's a shot of the hot burn, the wild and scenic Illinois River running clear and beautiful after the fire, brown and black and green mixed together, and here's a swath of hot burn here, where the terrain was influencing the fire here, not the fuels, but sort of the steepness of the terrain often leads to hotter burns as well. All of that is a contributor to the wild diversity of the Siskiyou forests. Now, in those hot burn areas, I want to show you some other shots. This is right after the fire was extinguished in 2002, not by firefighting, but by winter rains. That's the way these fires get put out. Winter rains came in, squelched the fire, and right away these ferns burst from the ground. It was like spring in the autumn, a beautiful sight. Here, mosses and nitrogen-fixing plants restoring nutrients to the soil, preparing the soil for the next generation of forest, a really beautiful phenomena. Whole fields of flowers coming back this year, like these fawn lilies and the calypso orchid with a delicate, beautiful smell. And of course, a lot of the bigger trees with their thick bark resisting the fire, completely unfazed. A few of their lower branches maybe burned by the heat from the ground, the needles then turning brown, falling down, and creating a protective mulch. Once the topsoil has been burned off by the fire, the needles fall down and protect it from the rains that are coming soon. A beautiful mechanism. And of course, seeds as well for the next generation of forests. You got to understand, these fires are not the death of a forest. These fires are the birth of a forest. This is how many of these trees give birth to the next generation. They literally cannot reproduce without it. It's a creative process, not a destructive one. This is a wonderful landscape to be in, and I encourage you to come down. Things are changing so fast. It's a resilient, beautiful ecosystem with surprises around every corner. And week to week now, because of the fire, things are changing. Always something new to see. That being said, not everything is rosy in the biscuit fire areas. This here, this moonscape here, was a so-called healthy forest. It was an old-growth forest that was logged and then replanted with a monoculture of even-aged Douglas fir trees packed closely together. It was growing quickly, robust, what many foresters would call a healthy forest because these trees were growing so quickly and they were producing lots of timber volume. The only trouble with these tree plantations is they are completely out of whack. Completely out of whack. They are tree plantations, they are not forests, and they are not resilient to the natural disturbances that come into forests and natural ecosystems, like fire, for example. When fire enters a tightly packed tree plantation like this, it explodes inflamed. They don't have thick bark to resist fires. Their branches are almost touching. And when the fire explodes in here, not a single tree is left alive, as you can see. The whole hillside, not a single tree. And the hot burn spreads even into the older forests nearby and then slowly calms down after a while. It's a sobering sight. When you look up at these hillsides and you see erosion already pouring down through the middle of them, you don't see baby trees coming back. You don't see soil being rejuvenated by needles from larger trees. You don't even see large dead trees creating habitat or returning to the soil, turning into nurse logs. When you look across these landscapes, not a single tree left, baked soils. You wonder, is this more of what we need on our national forests? Is this really something we need more of? Or should we be restoring these places, trying to turn them back into real forests rather than tree farms? Well, the Bush administration seems to think we need a lot more of these kinds of forests on our public lands because their logging project includes over 100,000 acres of new tree plantation creation in the backcountry of the Siskiyou. Not only that, they're planning the single largest logging project in the modern history of our national forests. Now, this is not only the biggest timber sale that anyone in this room has ever seen. It's the worst. They're not just nibbling at the edges of this wild place. They're going for the heart of it. They're going for the old growth reserves, areas normally off limits to logging. They're going for the roadless forest. It's the first challenge to the roadless rule in the United States. So what happens on the biscuit will happen to every roadless forest across the country. The Bush administration proposed 518 million board feet of logging. 518 million board feet. Translation, more logging than all of the logging in Oregon and Washington and Northern California, the national forests in those states, combined last year in one project. Put another way, if you stacked those 518 million board feet on the back of logging trucks and parked them bumper to bumper, you could go from the Canadian border to Mexico. You could walk from this room to Canada and then back down to Mexico without ever touching the ground on the backs of the log trucks. This is truly an extreme logging scheme. Now, I was really curious when this logging project came out. I wanted to know, how is the Bush administration and their friends in the timber industry going to justify this to the American public? How is this possibly going to fly? So I went to Roseburg, Oregon, which is kind of the timber capital of the state, and our senator, Gordon Smith, was having a forum there about how much he wanted to log the wild backcountry of the Siskiyou after the biscuit fire. And he brought with him Mark Ray. If you guys know this guy, he's a leading timber industry lobbyist for almost 20 years. Now he's the Undersecretary of Agriculture in charge of the Forest Service. In other words, the fox guarding the hen house. This guy here is Scott Conroy. He's the Rogue Siskiyou National Forest Supervisor. And over here, Hal Salwasser, who's a proponent of industrial logging, whether it's on national forests or state forests or private timberlands. He's a friend of the industry who masquerades as a scientist. So quite a lineup he had here. And I wondered, you know, the cameras are rolling. The press is taking notes. What are they going to say? How are they going to sell this to the American people? I almost fell off my chair. When they started talking, they were all perfectly aligned. They all had the same message, and it was, we need to do the biggest timber sale anywhere ever in the modern history of our national forests, through old growth reserves, through roadless forests, for the health of the forest. For the health of the rivers, for the health of the owls, for the health of the rare and endangered species that are out there, we need to do this project. Post-fire logging is a very serious thing. A lot of people think, what's the big deal? Dead trees, right? Trees don't care if they get logged. Problem is, scientists tell us, and if you walk on the ground, you'll realize instantly, that post-fire logging is the worst kind of logging, happening in the worst place at the worst time. Worst, worst, worst. Let's break it down. First, the soils. You know, if you've seen a logging project, you see a lot of damage to soils, and that's a real concern. After a fire, those soils are way more sensitive. And the impacts you normally see, like compaction, where heavy machinery runs over it and crushes down the soil so oxygen and water can't get in there, so baby trees can't grow back up, that takes effect for decades, if not 100 years, or more in some areas, crushing the soil down. Compaction is very serious. Second, erosion, way more prone to erosion after a fire. You got to understand, a lot of the topsoil has been burned off. Sometimes even the roots inside the soils have been burned. And so there's very little to protect these sensitive soils from erosion. And so I was standing on a sort of a misty day, not unlike today. It's hardly raining at all. And I watched streams of erosion just bleeding out of this post-fire landscape, combining with other erosion and going down to the wild and scenic Illinois River, this beautiful green that you see behind this pit of polluted water. And as I watched this polluted water bleed into the Illinois River, I couldn't help but think about the Chinook salmon that were returning from the Pacific to spawn. That's why I was down at the river. I wanted to see the salmon spawn. This is not what we need across tens of thousands of acres of the Siskiyou National Forest. Second, in addition to crushing and eroding the soils, post-fire logging increases fire risk. It increases fire risk by taking out the big trees that create shade, moderate the moisture, but also by leaving behind this flammable slash. It's the slash I told you about earlier, the sticks and the bark and the things that aren't worth pulling out in the back of a log truck, and they sit there and bake in the hot summer sun like kindling for 10 years, maybe more, until they degrade into the soil. So increasing fire risk for at-risk communities and for the forest. And third and most importantly, taking out the big trees, the big old-growth trees. These trees aren't dead trees. They're called snags. That's what forest scientists call them. Large standing trees. And these trees are literally the life of the forest. These large dead trees are the life of the forest. They actually turn into, they start sort of a second life, and they turn into these snags, and they provide a whole host of services to the critters that live in the forest. They're sources of food and habitat for bugs, bats, birds, black bears, all kinds of critters, almost like a supermarket and a high-rise condo in one for these guys. And per tree, forest scientists tell us per tree, these are more important than the large old-growth trees. There's fewer of them. And over decades, we've been systematically logging these out. They're just worthless. They're decadent. They're sitting there rotting, for God's sake. How dare them rot in our forests, you know? When they fall to the ground, they turn into nurse logs for baby trees, for restoring soils. When they fall into streams and rivers, they change the current of the river, slowing things up, creating important habitat for salmon and steelhead. Their list of services go on for pages. And to get an old-growth snag, you first need an old-growth tree. Then that tree needs to die, and then it needs to degrade and transform into a snag. So let's say it's a 300-year-old snag. The problem with the Bush administration's proposal is if they take out the snag forest now, there's no other way to get 300-year-old snags than to wait 300 years. Talk about long-term consequences. This is a huge problem. In addition to that, and adding insult to injury, this logging project would cost taxpayers, not give back to the federal treasury, cost taxpayers $100 million, maybe more, at a time when schools aren't adequately funded, at a time when there are cutbacks and rollbacks and all kinds of important programs. They want to waste taxpayer money on a huge subsidy for a few large politically connected timber corporations at the expense of anyone who's trying to make a living off of tourism, recreation, the fisheries, at the expense of even other timber companies, especially the small guys, maybe even ones that are trying to make money off their own private timberlands and aren't getting a slice of this heavily subsidized pie. You can imagine when they do all this cutting, this gigantic timber sale, and throw that wood on the market, prices will drop, and these private timberland owners we'll have to deal with reductions as much as 20% in the cost of wood in the region. A real devastation. Doesn't make any sense, of course. We have a different vision for this area. Siskiyou Wild Rivers National Conservation Area, a protected place, truly protected for future generations. And it would include fire safety for at-risk communities, real fire safety, the way we know it needs to be done. Second, restoration of previously mismanaged areas. There's no shortage of things to work on out there, whether it's pulling out those roads or restoring those so-called healthy forests. And third, of course, protection for the world-class wildlands, extraordinary botanical diversity in wild rivers. So that's what we want to see done instead of this extreme logging scheme. And now we're standing at an extremely important point in time. This is not about whether we're going to lose a few acres here or going to be nibbling at the edges of the Wild Rivers area. The very future of this huge, incredibly important wildland is at stake. The Bush administration wants to drive chainsaws into the heart of it. And if we let them do that, we'll lose this place for all time. So now is the time to act. And that's why we're on the road. That's why we're on this biodiesel bus. That's why we're going from San Francisco to Oakland to Portland to Corvallis to Bellingham to Olympia, all over the West Coast, rallying thousands of people, getting 1,000 letters, doing all kinds of things, organizing people, educating people about what needs to happen here, how we can really win this fight. And I think we can win. 23,000 people weighed in on the draft logging plans that the Bush administration put out. 23,000 people from coast to coast. We have got the momentum here, folks. We have the science in our corner. We have public opinion in our corner. We're having more fun than they're having. We're going to beat them. But there's one reason why we have to work hard right now. And that is that bureaucrats and politicians sometimes don't make decisions based on what's best for the public or what the scientists tell us, believe it or not. Sometimes they're thinking about things like money and power rather than those other things. I know it's shocking. You guys, sorry to break that to you. And so I know that there's a possibility that the public and our environmental laws could be pulled out of the process. The Bush administration's already saying they want to do this. And so if the public gets pulled out of the process and our environmental laws get thrown out the window, then I can imagine early one morning on the dusty roads leading into the backcountry of the Siskiyou, log trucks and chainsaws could come rumbling up